This is March Twisdale, producer and host of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, and I'd like to welcome you to my new show, Focus On. Today, I'm talking with one of 8 guest writers who will be joining me on Focus On, my new show, which will highlight other countries and cultures around the world through the voices of their writers. And today, I'm talking with, and I am going to totally say this name wrong, but I'm going to do my best, Hildur Knutsdóttir from Iceland. So now, Hildur, how about you tell everyone how you actually say your name?
It's Hildur Knutsdóttir.
That sounds so much better. So I've been given permission to say Hildur during the interview because that's about the best I can pull off. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So let's give people a little sense here of what's going on. I'm here on Vashon and the Voice of Vashon Studios, and you are in Iceland, but are you in Reykjavik or somewhere else?
Yeah, I'm in Reykjavik, in the west part of Reykjavik, looking out at the ocean here.
All right. And so there is, we thought there was a 7-hour gap, but now I think there's, it's you're 8 hours behind us.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, got it. And what I always do is I let my guest writers give our listeners a little bit of a baseline, sort of who they are and what brings them to their writing and anything about you that you think is important. Mm-hmm. So how about you dive in?
Okay. My name is Hildur Knutsdóttir. I am 32 years old. And I've been writing a lot since I was maybe 18 years old. I decided I wanted to become a writer really young because I always loved reading. But when I was 18, I just sat down, you know, started writing every day almost. But my first book didn't come out until almost 10 years later when I was 28 years old. And that was called Slaughter or A Change of Heart. But that wasn't my first book. Like, it wasn't the first book I wrote. I wrote 2 that are just sitting somewhere in my computer, which I think a lot of writers have to do because you have to practice writing. I've never thought about whether I should write for children or teenagers or young adults. But my books have been labeled as, you know, for teenagers or young adults a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I read a lot of that stuff, and I think almost all my books have a bit of the fantastical, some fantastical elements. I think it's just a bit more exciting than the everyday.
Yeah. And you have 2 daughters, I think?
Yeah, one is 4 years old, and the other one is almost 2. She'll be 2 in the start of January now.
Right on. Okay. Mm-hmm. Your books are translated into which languages?
French, only French, but hopefully more.
Oh, I thought you had one in German already.
No, I don't.
Okay. So what language are they written in?
Icelandic.
Okay, so it is called Icelandic?
Yeah, it's called Icelandic, yeah.
Okay, good. The reason that I invited you onto the show was because I was so very inspired by a video that your publisher shared with me. I don't think it was so much a TED Talk, but you were presenting somewhere and talking just so eloquently about a feeling and a position you find yourself in that I think everyone listening to this show shares, which is a sense of awareness that there are some big, big problems in the world that are going to affect all of us, paired with an awareness that I am one of billions and there's very little I can necessarily do. And how do we grapple with that dichotomy of looming disaster and a feeling that I may be too small to contribute meaningfully? And you were finding a way to overcome that and move forward. Do you want to share about that?
Yeah, well, it's something that I think about a lot because I know a lot about climate change and other environmental issues. And like this talk, it was from a conference on microplastics in our oceans,
right?
Which is a really, it's a really big issue that a lot of people don't know about. Like they're finding plastic everywhere, even you know, in the flesh of fishes and other organisms in the ocean, and it's finding its way into our food chain and affecting us. So it's like we are under threat, and sometimes it feels like the threat is looming everywhere. So it's really easy just to be filled with dread and be paralyzed and do nothing, and also to feel that you as one person can't do anything about it really. But and I am quite against, like, some people say that the responsibility should fall on the individual to do something. I don't agree with that, because I think governments should take the lead, just in banning microbeads, for example, or pushing taxes on hazards, what's it called?
Industry.
Taxes on industry and carbon taxes and whatnot.
You
But
know, I'm really glad you brought up microbeads, because I was actually going to bring that up in a minute. So I want to catch that before we get too far along for folks that are listening. So microbeads are, if you've ever seen those commercials, which you probably have, for like cleansers and feminine care products, oftentimes that have microbeads, little teeny tiny things that are full of special oils, and when you rub them on your hand or your face or whatever, they'll burst, and it's this really great, wonderful thing. Well, they're literally little plastic capsules, and they don't like just melt and go away. They withstand, they exist like plastic does. And that was the big one that caught me a few years ago, was the awareness of the, if you think of the billions of bottles of these care products, and when people use them, then they hop in the shower and it washes off their body and gets right into the ocean and the rivers. And so I'm assuming that's what you meant by microbeads as well.
It's microbeads in products, but also just like plastic. Because if you throw away a plastic bag and it goes into the ocean, it breaks down into microplastics, and
But the
these particles,
microbeads,
like,
I think there's something that people can intentionally at the store say, oh, you know what? I really do want a great cleanser. I want a good cream. I want whatever, but I don't want to buy that one with the microbeads. I'm going to buy this one, which just is plain lotion or whatever. You
And
know.
like a lot of what's it called? The thing you put in your tooth, like toothpaste. Some toothpastes have microbeads, when
Oh,
they could just as easily have like silica, beads or something. And so it's just, and you use it for like 2 seconds, but then the plastic never breaks down. Like they never. They have no evidence of plastic breaking down, because it takes such a long time that the plastic, like the first plastic that we that was manufactured, it hasn't broken down,
And that was like, what, 90 years ago or 70 years ago or something?
Yeah, I think so. So yes, so you're using a product for a few seconds, and then it stays in the environment forever.
And it's not controlled. It's loose and free flowing and causing problems everywhere.
And now, like, they're inspecting sewage systems, because they're supposed to have some mechanisms to rinse it out before it goes into the ocean, but it's not working
Oh, right,
properly.
to filter it or something. Yeah, that'd be probably,
Like filters. So it's yeah, like plastic is almost everywhere in the ocean, and it's horrible, because like a lot of the plastics that we use, it's just, we use it for 2 minutes or 10 minutes going home from the store, a plastic bag, but then it stays, exists for hundreds of years.
Yeah, it's interesting, because every time you bring up a concern about plastics, oftentimes what you hear is people say, but our life is so much better. You need IV bags. And, you know, imagine the medical world without plastics. And it's like, but we're not actually talking about IV bags. We're not talking about that. We're talking about the wasteful, unimportant, like you say, use it for 2 minutes and then it's gone, uses of plastic. I mean, if you simply eliminated the unnecessary uses, that would make a huge dent in the problem. It's not like we want to go back to the dark ages at the doctor's office.
Yeah, and it's the same with carbon. I don't think it's
Yeah.
realistic that we stop, burning carbon, but I think we should, use our carbon budget for something that really matters, not just,
Yeah.
doing something silly and, yeah. So what? Yeah. So
So
I
what are
am
you
totally.
doing as a, how are you feeling empowered as an individual to take a step forward that you feel has a meaningful potential for meaningful impact?
Yes, well, I think that we are beyond. I think like the situation is so dire that we don't have time to wait for every individual on the planet to realize, the scale of our
Right.
problems,
Right.
and I don't think that everybody has, access to the right media that are telling, the truths, or, even education to know what's going on. So I don't think that we have time, just to wait for individuals to, make the right reasons as consumers. So
Right.
I think we definitely need our government to step up and create an environment, or like, yeah, create a system so that you don't have to, just take these decisions when you're in the store or the
Right.
supermarket.
Right.
But at the same time, knowing what I know, I feel that I can't, me as an individual should also be doing everything that's in my power. And I know that like what I buy is not, or don't buy or do and don't do is not going to, stop pollution or,
Right.
of microbeads or, save the climate. But it's also a way just, to live with myself, knowing that I'm, contributing, as little to the problem as I can.
So in a way, you want to be able to feel good when you look in the mirror.
It's like, yeah, I think it's about that, feeling good about myself, because when I do something that, I know is polluting, then I feel bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, but then it's also I also read a really interesting report on energy consumption and how to influence people, and like the thing that worked best, like first they tried, upping the prices and, trying to, have incentives to make people use less energy.
Right.
But the thing that worked best was saying, yeah, you use, 30% more than your neighbor. And then people started using less energy because it was like a weird form of peer pressure. So,
Right. Not like calling
yeah.
people out individually or shaming them, but just to say, wow, you actually could be doing better. Other people are doing better in that way.
Yeah. And it's also
Interesting
like,
idea.
yeah, and also like Iceland is really small, and everybody knows everybody,
Yeah.
almost. So like every few years we have these crises that seem to grip the nation, like everybody's doing paleo diet and
Right.
everybody's, doing this or doing that.
Right.
So you can have like this frenzy of some things here. So I think
Yeah.
like peer pressure is a really big thing here in Iceland, I
It
think.
can be a positive thing. I mean, World War II, the government decided that they wanted to motivate Americans to voluntarily be happy about less chocolate and less nylons and less gasoline and grow a victory garden. And so the government was able to literally turn practically the entire nation into feeling like we're helping out the Europeans who were dealing with this horrible war and the people in the Pacific and our soldiers by doing without. So it became this high
Yeah.
value. And then I
Yeah.
think somehow we moved into such an addicted capitalistic system that the idea of suggesting, hey, maybe don't buy a new phone every single year and wait for two or three upgrades before you get your next phone. How long can you make your cell phone last? I mean, nothing like that is even like considered acceptable in this culture because it would immediately put a dent in the profit making for an industry. And so there's like this, the government just sits there and says, we have all this power to influence behavior and we're not going to use it because we're under pressure to allow, for-profit activities to go unimpeded. And yet they're all resource consumption-based activities.
Yeah, but I was just, a few months ago looking at one of the ads that were run during the Second World War from the government, and like one ad said, if you write alone, you write with Hitler. So they were like really direct, and it was like a picture, it was like a cartoon of a man driving alone in his car, and sitting next to him was like this shadowy image of Hitler.
Well, so they're encouraging carpooling.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, well, I think it would be really great if you could like turn this on its head, because like in Iceland, it usually has been working like that. Like everybody has this vase that they bought at this store, or everybody has these shoes, and now like everybody has the same backpack. So, but it would be really nice if, to see if you could somehow, influence people into not buying something.
So I'm going to do a really quick station identification, folks. If you have just joined the show, you're listening to March Twisdale, producer and host of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, you've surely heard of. But now I have a new spin-off show as well, and it is called Focus On. And this is a show where I'm going to go to individual countries around the world and talk with writers from that country and that culture as a way of sort of exploring what's working well, the interests, the issues, and what's happening in other places on our planet, based basically in an idea that I believe Americans have a lot to learn from their fellow earthlings in other places. And that's what this show is all about. So today I am interviewing, I'm going to say it wrong because I don't speak the language, Hildur Knutsdottir. And we're going to get back to that interview in a second, but I want to thank Vashon Dental for supporting this program. Vashon Dental operates a family practice providing dental care in a relaxed environment and committed to providing personalized care and treatment for every individual's unique needs. Located across from the Vashon Center for the Arts at 19715 Vashon Highway Southwest. Also, support for this program comes from Vashon Heating and Cooling, a full-service heating, cooling, and energy management company. They will diagnose your home or office HVAC problems and offer on-site solutions for energy savings. You can contact them at 206-463-1777. And now, Hildur, how about you go ahead and tell everyone how you pronounce your name properly?
Hildur
Thank you. Okie doke.
Knutsdottir.
So we are already at 26 minutes into this show, so we're going to have to make sure we cover everything that we were going to touch on. So I'm going to
Okay.
move us a little bit. We've been talking about the question of how does an individual, all of us listening to this show right now, everyone alive on the planet, pretty much has this awareness of big problems in the world and the smallness of who we are as individuals, the sense of how can I make a meaningful difference. And so we've been sort of talking about that. Real quick, last thing I want to say on climate change is you live in Iceland. That is way farther north than we are here in the continental US. And I would imagine you have been seeing firsthand some of the actual effects of climate change. What's going on environmentally in Iceland?
Well, the glaciers are retreating really fast. And like this month, it's been really warm here. The last 2 months, it's November, and I saw that I just saw buds on the tree in my garden, so the tree is thinking that it's spring again.
Oh, I'm sorry. What temperatures are you at? I know you do Celsius, so how do we, not sure how to convert, but.
I think yesterday was like 8 degrees Celsius, which is really weird for this time. And like last week we had like 16 degrees Celsius, which is
Wow.
just ridiculous for this time.
We have been about 20 to 30 degrees above normal for the last month. There was a bunch of rain in October, but still, it's the middle of November, and it's like if you go outside wearing a sweatshirt and you go for a walk, you end up taking the sweatshirt off and walking in a t-shirt, and it's in the
Yeah.
middle of November. That's not normal.
Yeah. No,
Yeah.
it's not normal here.
Yeah.
Yeah, and yeah, like the glaciers are retreating, and the fish, no, like or like the fish stocks are moving. Iceland is
Right.
a really big fishing nation, and the acidification and the warming of the ocean is probably going to be a really big problem for us in the
Right.
coming years. And the fish industry is also, the fishing industry is starting to get really worried, I think,
Yeah.
now.
Yeah, we've been dealing here on the Pacific coast along California, Oregon, Washington, what they call the blob, which is that huge hot water thing. And supposedly you go from like El Nino to La Nina, and it's supposed to be like a whole year switch. And if I understand correctly, about a month and a half ago, it was a 3 week switch, and we're right back where we were. Literally 3 weeks, and the blob is back. That's part of why we're so hot. But it's not in the media. What does your media do in Iceland? Do they cover the stuff?
They cover it a lot. Like I've seen a really big change since the Paris Agreement. They've been
Yeah.
covering it a lot, but we just had elections, and they didn't talk about it so much.
Now you ran for a seat. Real quickly, a little bit about this. You obviously have a different system of government than we do. And so, like, how many parties are there in Iceland?
I think we had there were like 10 parties or 11 parties running now
Okay.
for the parliament, but that was really big because there was a really big we knew that there was going to be quite a big change now because we had elections early because a lot of officials from our government were in the Panama Papers.
Right.
So they, so like our prime minister had money in offshore accounts,
Right.
and also our minister of interior and also our finance minister. So we had like this really big protest.
Well, they got
And
kicked out, basically, right?
well, the prime minister got kicked out, but the minister of interior and the finance minister, they got like the majority vote. They got their party got 30%. And we haven't formed the government yet, but like our president, he's like, yeah, he doesn't have any political power. He's like the monarch, you know, of
Right.
England or something, but he's like the official head of the government, and he gave like this party, you know, what's it called? It's called Stjórnarmyndunarumboð. It's called like so. He said, okay, now you can go and form a government. But they
Right,
haven't been
right.
able to in those 2 weeks, so I don't know what's going to happen. We don't have a government.
So this is the gentleman who I believe was a history professor, and his wife is Eliza, right? Yeah, yeah,
Exactly.
yeah. Yeah, Eliza's planning to be on. So the first lady, she has agreed to be on the show, but we haven't been able to pick a date yet that works for both of our
Okay.
schedules.
Yes, it's probably busy.
Yeah, oh, right, exactly. So I think this is so what I found fascinating about Iceland a number of years ago, 2008 in particular, was that I believe. Now, real quick on smallness. So, my understanding is, because of course we have 350 million people or so in our country, this big giant thing we live in. And I believe you guys have about 325,000 people in Reykjavik
No, in Iceland.
in the entire country. Okay. That is half the size of Seattle. So, for everyone listening, just take a second. The entire country, that this nation that Hildur lives in, that all these people live in, their country is half the size of the city of Seattle as far as population. And you were talking earlier about how everyone knows everyone. My impression is that part of why you were so successful at dealing with the collapse in 2008 was that there's a bit of a personal affront when you find out that your government and your bankers have been doing things that are messing everything up, because they're like your neighbors and your kids go to school with their kids. And I just had the sense that people were more active because they felt closer to those who were doing harm. Does that at all ring true? Or what do you think is going on?
Well, yeah, I think that's true, but there's also the flip side. Like, if you see somebody, when you go to the grocery store or your kids go to the same kindergarten, then, although you get really, you can feel really betrayed by that person, but then again, you know them, so it's also really hard to see them go to jail, for example. So there was like this when they actually jailed some of the banksters. They call them banksters here, like a gangster
Yes,
and some
yes.
bankers. Yeah, when they actually jailed them, there was actually some outcry here, because it's also hard to know, to look at people being locked up. And so, and I think you also tend to forgive people that you know more than people that you don't know. And being such a small community, it's really easy to, come together and do things, which I think is a strong point for us. It's like yeah, easy to say like, oh no, no, okay, now let's do this all together. But then again, you also have a lot of corruption, because people, like, everybody knows everybody, and they had a hard time finding judges who could, be the judges in the cases of these banksters, because everybody went to the same schools, and this was, his father-in-law and his brother and his sister, so everybody was connected, and they had family in parliament, and in the police, so it's that's also hard. So you have corruption,
Well, and
which
the thing is that happens here too. So in our country, it ends up being like the same corruption's there, but it's like a class-based corruption. It's sort of like, you end up with the wealth class that just sits around patting each other on the back and all that. And then you have this massive, we used to be a massive middle class, but now it's a small middle class and a massive poverty class. And they're just, I think I think if I was dealing with human frailty and weaknesses, I would rather be in a small country where you at least really could reach out and touch and see who that person was, than to have them 9 states away and, just completely out of touch. But I haven't lived in Iceland, so I don't know.
No, yeah, but it's smaller. Like, if you go, to the swimming pool, you could meet, the president there, or, if you just go downtown walking and,
Well, let's
So.
touch a little bit on feminism. I
Okay.
have a friend who lives on the island, and he dated a woman from Iceland for a few years, and he would travel to Iceland with her to visit her family. And his impression was that the country has is the way he put it was that it's practically a matriarchy, and that the women have great influence in the society. And so I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, well, Iceland has repeatedly been ranked as the best country in the world to be a woman. I always get kind of frustrated when people, talk about like Iceland as this ideal place, because I don't think Icelandic women should compare themselves to women in other countries. They should compare themselves to men in Iceland. And we still get paid, I think it's 18% less than men.
I don't even understand how that happens. That's just like so weird.
Yeah, and like it's also in government institutions, and yeah, so, and like violence against women exists here.
Oh yeah, sure, it's everywhere.
Yeah, and also like something that I've been grappling with a lot is because Iceland is a really gendered language, and you can, and like also just in figures of speech and like brotherhood, it's the same in Icelandic, and like it's like your fatherland, you say, and behave like a man, don't cry like a girl, and
Right.
also like, yeah, and it's like, and it's, I think it's same like in English, like dog is a pretty neutral word, but bitch is not a neutral word, you
No,
know,
no.
and bull and cow, you know, it's the same thing. So things are not ideal here in Iceland, but they're definitely better than in a lot of countries. But I don't think that we should get complacent here, and you have to still have to fight. And like, and also like in the literary scene, we have more male writers, and they get most of they get a lot of the awards. But like I studied creative writing, and a majority of the students were women, but somehow they don't make it, you know.
Right. I was at I can't remember. I've been to a number of different writing conventions and stuff. I don't remember which one exactly, but often there will be a booth there from a group that is specifically raising the point of, we have so many more men who become published writers. And yet when you look at you go to a conference, you go to a writing retreat, and it'll be like, 85% women, 15% men. And then you go look at the names on published books, and it's sort of it's different. What is it like for you raising daughters?
Well, it was really like my older daughter, she's 4 years old, and I've always been really, you know, obsessed with, you know, the color pink, and like everything that's, you know, marketed to girls is pink. So
Or it's baby dolls, or it's house cleaning products that have been turned into toys. Let's carry the
they're all
baby
pink.
around and vacuum and have fun and make believe, right?
And so like so it's really easy to, you know, indoctrinate children basically. So what is like the things that are pink, they are meant for you. And also they have like this pink tax, you know, toys that are pink are usually 15% more expensive than toys that are blue.
Oh, it's like with razors. If you buy a man's razor, women are paying more money for the same thing. What is up
And
with that?
so like when I when my daughter was born, I was really conscious of, you know, having her in gender neutral colors. But then there just came a point when she was, I don't know, 2.5 or 3 years old, and she just started having really strong opinions on what to wear, and she just wanted to wear pink.
Oh my
And
goodness.
then I just realized that like you as a parent, you know, it's truly the village that raises, you know, the child. And so it really doesn't matter. Just or maybe I should say it's not only what you say or what you do. You know, it's everywhere. It's in the TV, and you know, and at the kindergarten. So, and you also don't want to, like, you know, tell her not to wear pink, because then you're you know, belittling what she likes, and that's also not a good thing. So I have had to embrace the pink lifestyles, and now I buy pink dresses for my girl and pink toys because I know she likes it, and I want her to be happy. But I'm also thinking about like how can I counterbalance this. And
It comes to mind for me that a lot of times it's the activities that are the counterbalance. You can have a girl who wears pink and she is always taking selfies on her smartphone and she's worried about makeup and she basically does nothing except maybe schoolwork. Or you have the girl who loves to wear pink while she's riding her horse or
I
climbing
know.
on a cliff. I mean, sometimes I think it can be the do that matters, the empowering place.
So like I always keep in mind, like I never tell her not to do something because her dress will get ruined because she really likes nice dresses, but she doesn't really care if they're really muddy or, you know, if she has chocolate all over, you know. So I just let her play, you know. So, and yeah, like I was reading about children's clothing, and clothing for girls is usually in, you know, lighter colors, and in like for more flimsy material, so it gets, you know, it's get more it's get it's it gets torn more easily.
And it's
So
colder. It's colder. It's
yeah,
thinner
and it's cold.
materials, like, wow.
And so parents are probably telling, girls more than boys, no, don't do that. You're gonna ruin your dress, or So I try to be conscious of not telling her that. But like when you're talking about, not leaving girls alone somewhere, or I think that's an difficult issue for me, for example, because I think you can't be constraining, women's freedom in society by telling them not to walk home alone, because then they can't decide themselves when they go home if they have to wait for somebody else. And so, like, I decided many years ago that I'm just going to walk home if I've been in a bar, because I refuse to be, imprisoned,
Yeah, you don't want to feel like you don't want as the female to feel like you need a chaperone, and I totally get
Oh,
that.
and it's like it's my country, it's my city. I should be able to walk the streets, but then again, I don't have teenagers, so I don't know how I will feel about that. But I saw like this really funny blog post about raising girls and raising boys. It was about, instead of, telling girls how not to get raped, you should tell boys not to rape. And there was like talking about, find a buddy system. You should, have a buddy, and he should help you not to rape.
Right. Oh, I think
So,
I saw that too.
yeah. And so, if you feel that you are in danger of raping somebody, you should call your buddy. So it was a really funny twist.
Yeah, I think it was on Facebook. I totally saw the same thing. It
Yeah.
was sort of like a cartoon thing, like squares, and it had like, different things you could. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
So.
I totally, I think if I was raising girls, I would totally, that'd be the conversation of you don't want them to feel like they have to have a chaperone. But most parents would probably say, if you're going to go to a party, I want you to take a friend and I want you to leave with your friend. I mean, the buddy system is really important because there are predators, and you don't want your son to be the one who, thinks it's totally not an issue to go to a party, leave their friend there, and find out the next day that, she was raped by five guys in the bedroom while she was passed out. So it's there's the real world and there's the ideal world, and how do we grapple between the two?
Yeah, I know. And also, like, if I had ever been attacked, I would probably, think differently on walking home alone, but I haven't, so, and I'm lucky. But anyway, like, I think the stats are, I think it's like 2 in 5 women in Iceland have been attacked, sexually or not non-sexually. So, like, so even though Iceland on paper sometimes looks like an ideal place, I mean, we
Well, that's actually better than the US. US is one in
again, I don't
three.
want to. Yeah, but then I don't want to, belittle what, I mean, what we have achieved, which is a lot. Yeah, but we just have to keep fighting and not get complacent.
Absolutely. It's interesting. So this show will go into my archives. So in fact, this is great. So hi everyone. If you've just joined us, this is Marge Twisdale, and you probably already know my normal show, which is Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. This is the beginning of my spin-off show, which is Focus On. This show plays twice a week, and so does Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. They're both going to be happening every week. You can pick them up at 101.9 FM, KVSH, or you can come check them out on online 24/7 anywhere in the world. And the focus of these first 8 shows is going to be on the country and culture of Iceland, viewed through the writers of that country, the ones I'm able to get on an interview. And so we're talking about all sorts of amazing stuff, but none of this would be possible if it weren't for the support of our, gosh, well, there's so many people who support Voice of Vashon, and I'm going to go ahead and give some shout outs here. I would like to say thank you to Amion Associates Real Estate. Looking for a green realtor? Emma Amion is a certified eco broker with over 25 years experience selling real estate on Vashon Island. I know her, I love her, I bought my house from her. I think she's a great person to work with. Also, I have friends who've worked with Windermere, and they have given a great deal of support to Voice of Vashon in making our emergency alert service possible. And that's those flashing red lights you see when you come on the island, or you can listen on the radio. If there's something going on, you can find out and stay safe. So many thanks to our sponsors. And now back to the interview. So we've got about 12 more minutes.
Okay.
So I'm talking with, you just say your name. You say it better than I do.
Yeah, Hildur
There we go.
Knutsdóttir.
Hildur has, of course, her bio is on my website, which is my personal website, which is marchtwisdale.com, as well as on Voice of Vashon. I'm not going to try to spell all the words because they're interesting, but she's written a number of novels. She has a duology of horror fiction, a piece that just came out that she co-wrote, 2016. Let's see. Let's talk about awards for a minute, because
Okay.
in the United States of America, we have some awards that are given out to writers, but they're like one-time awards. They're not from the government, generally that I'm aware of. They're from like nonprofit art support groups, and they're like a
Yeah.
one-time deal in general. Why don't you tell us? It looks like you guys have basically that the country itself, there's a whole history, and I'm going to talk with that with another guest. But for writers in Iceland, where you've only got 325,000 people in the whole country, making a living on your writing purely from a capitalistic book-selling perspective, it sounds like that's not realistic. So how does Iceland ensure a thriving writing community?
Well, it's the award system is yeah, we have like this one, like the biggest award. It's called Íslensku Bókmenntaverðlaunin, or like the Icelandic Literary Prize. That's not from the government. It's from like all the publishers in Iceland. They have this communal body, and they give out this award. And it's yeah, and it's only like 1 million Icelandic kroners, which is not a lot of money. But the government, so it's more like an honorary award. But the government has like these salaries, writers' salaries, they're called, and that's just the amount that the government decides every year how much money they're going to give out. And I think last year it was about 500 million Icelandic kroners. I don't know the dollars.
Is it
Yeah, and
enough for a parent to take care of a family on their own?
no, you have to freelance or do something, so it's basically like half of a decent salary, I would say.
Yes, got it.
But so but if you're ready to if you can live frugally, or yeah, or share housing if you're married, and then it goes a long way. And especially because, I mean, you do get some money from your books. If they sell okay, I mean, it's not enough to live on, but it definitely complements the writer's salary.
And you've
So
had
yes.
your work translated into French, so I'm assuming, does this mean it's also being published in France?
Yeah, I think it's going to come out this spring, I think, in French. Yeah. Yeah, but so yeah, so like the government has this system to support the arts, and they also have salaries for musicians and other artists, and also for theaters and dancers. And I think without this, really, we wouldn't have a writing community here in Iceland. Then we would maybe have three selling big time in Germany.
So
But
basically, if I'm reminding the listeners for a second, so the population of Iceland is equal to about half the size of Seattle.
yeah.
So if you were to think of, you go to Seattle, and I'm just talking down like literally the city of Seattle, not the surrounding regions at all. There's about 600,000 in Seattle. So you like chop Seattle in half, take all those people, plunk them in the middle of the Olympic mountain range with basically no one else around, and say, there, you're a country. Go do what you want to do. And
Yeah.
so basically people said, well, we really want writers, and there's a huge number of people who publish. What is it? 1 in 10 will publish a book in Iceland? You have a massive pro-publishing culture.
We have a lot of people writing and a lot of people publish books, poetry or children's books or just, novels or also their biographies, So we have this big tradition of publishing and yeah, and I think it's also, I think like if you want to preserve the language, then you have to, give some money to the arts, I think, because otherwise Icelandic is just going to be dead in a few decades.
You know, Denmark has, I think there's 5.6 million people in the world who speak Danish. So that's a pretty small number. And about a year and a half ago, the Danish government decided to come out with this big, ironically, given global issues, they were so concerned with 5.6 or so million Danes, they put out a big government push to encourage people to have babies, Danish couples, to have more children at a younger age. And sure enough, this last summer, there was this onslaught, and the midwives were like, they had twice as many babies being born. And, and part of it was a holding on to your culture and making sure that you're going to maintain your culture through more of your people. At the same time, of course, we have global population crisis. So I found it an interesting idea.
And this is a big debate here in Iceland also, because we don't have money to translate the Windows XP or the environment in the computers, so children are, and also we don't have a lot of money to translate cartoons for children, so children here learn a lot of English, very seem to know more English than Icelandic, or at least have a better vocabulary. And also because, I mean, if you don't read in Icelandic, then there are a lot of words that you're never going to learn because,
You won't run into them in casual conversation. Well, that now, how about the schools? Are they taught in English or Icelandic?
No, Icelandic. But it was like this really, it was also part of the debate before the financial collapse. The banksters, because they had become international banks, and some of them were like really saying like, let's just switch to English because it's much more convenient and we don't have to translate everything. But I've been doing this, and like the writers, we have like this, it's not like it's like what's it called? It's not a union, but it's or it's like the writers' union here in Iceland. They
Or
have like this
collective
out.
or something.
It's like a union or a collective. It's not really like a union, but it's like a union collective. They have like this outreach program, which I've actually been a part of now, going to schools and having these writing workshops for children aged 10 to 13 years old. And I'm trying to get them to write something and get their imagination going. And a lot of the times they ask me, how do you say, and then they say a word in English, how do you say that in Icelandic? So yeah, so it's going to be, and some people are projecting that Iceland, like Icelandic, is going to die out in, I don't know, 50 or 60 years, which would be a pity, but I think, I mean, something else will replace it. I think like we're always going to write stories, and I think there's people want to hear stories and they want to be entertained. So I think Icelandic writers will, continue to write. But maybe,
That's a fascinating perspective. I think so my family, I definitely would like to get my kids out of America and into another country for a few years so they can really start to feel and taste and sense the difference. You can't get it from travel. You have to live somewhere to get it. And I feel like in America, since it's so big, you can travel your whole life and never leave the continental US and still have seen a lot of places. And so many Americans have virtually, well, the vast majority of Americans never live anywhere other than America ever. So they just don't have that perspective. And I think I'm already thinking like of Denmark is where I'm sort of aiming for my family. And to me, I
Yeah.
think, oh, there's only, there's less than 6 million. That's going to be totally different. But my goodness gracious, your country, your worldview is that's got to be just so different to actually be wondering if in 50 years from now, your language will have been held on to or not. That's,
Yeah.
it's interesting. What do you think is the best thing that you guys get out of being such a tight-knit and close community? There's got to be a level of intimacy. What do you think is the best thing that comes out of that?
Well, I think it's like probably a sense of community because I know like people in the States, like you were talking about, they can move to another city for a job. And then they know nobody in that city. They don't have a family or friends. So I feel like families are scattered around. But here, I think families usually live quite close. And like here in Reykjavik, I have my mother and my father and my mother's husband and my mother-in-law and my sister and a lot of friends. So for example, I can always get somebody to babysit for me. And my children are in really, close contact with their grandparents and, all the extended families. And for example, we have a lot of divorced couples here in Iceland who are co-raising their children. So they just live, really close to each other and they have like a weekend week. So, and people, so I think that's a really good thing here in Iceland. And because when a big part of the population lives here in Reykjavik. And it means that almost everybody's here,
Well, and living together, living with people, it requires a whole specific set of sort of social skills. And I think when you live in a culture where by necessity, by normalcy, or by choice, you can be so far away from people and have a more isolated sort of situation, you don't necessarily cultivate the same skills, the idea of it almost being normal for divorced couples to have most likely an amicable divorce and a sharing of the kids. I would imagine it would be hard to be having a very aggressive, non-amicable divorce because you're surrounded by all of your friends and family neighbors who are watching you have those problems. It almost seems like maybe there's more effort goes into figuring out how to work together.
Yeah, and I mean that's also a byproduct of good equality among the sexes that fathers here are really active in their children's lives, but and of course they want to continue that after divorce. So I think it's like now for my generation, it's more common than not to have, I think like on a week and week basis, and also we Icelanders. A lot of them are divorced, or a lot of them even don't marry. I think I'm always laughing about it. People really don't marry a lot here in Iceland. It's like I think in the States you have like a really different view of matrimony and like this nuclear family, I think, than here.
The nuclear family is like seen as being the starting point, and you have a sense that the extended family feels more like your starting point. All righty. So we've pretty much covered most of the points we were gonna jump in on. You ran for a seat recently, and the election was October 29th, and you were running for one of the more dominant groups, which is the Left Greens Party. Is that correct? And you specifically wanted to make sure that the conversation around climate change was a part of the race and what was going on.
I have no aspirations of being a politician, but like I was talking about earlier, given what I know and knowing the urgency, and wanting to live with myself, and I like when I decided to run, I was thinking like, 50 years, in the future, looking back, am I going to be happy with what I did? Did I do everything I could? And also, because I was talking about I think it's too late just to wait for the market to take care of it or individuals. So I think I really do think that we need government to step up and, take action. So I decided, put my money where my mouth was, and try to do something about it.
Or
But then I
put
was
your
also
time
like,
where you're
But then I was also, I admit, a little relieved that, because that I didn't get a seat because I have a lot of very exciting writing projects lined up, which I probably wouldn't have been able to do,
But what a great
if
example
I
to
would,
your daughter, your 4-year-old. She's old enough to know what's going on, and to see you stepping up, taking action, engaging, and basically, pursuing meaningful actions in your life.
I mean, I want to be able to say, well, at least I tried, and that's the only thing we can do, basically, I think, because you never know, if you actually achieve something, but the only thing you can do is try and do your best.
Absolutely. Well, Hildur, unfortunately, we are out of time, which is always such a bummer.
Okay.
I'm having so much fun with all of my guests. I never want to stop. So thank you very much for joining me today, all the way from Reykjavik, Iceland, via
Iceland,
Skype. You gotta love Skype. It's wonderful. And thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, and I believe I'm getting a copy of your one or two of your books, even though they're not translated into English. So people who are local can go ahead and swing by the Vashon Bookshop and take a look and actually see some Icelandic writing. It's a very beautiful language.
Yeah, they're probably on their way. Post takes a long time to the States from here. For some reason, yeah.
All right. Okay. Well, that's our show, folks. My name is March Twisdale, and you've been listening to my interview. I'm going to say it wrong, but it's Hildur Knutsdóttir. Oh, gosh, just say it.
Hildur
There you go. It's beautiful.
Knutsdóttir.
So normally you're listening to me on prose, poetry, and purpose, but today is actually Focus On, which is my new show where we bring home great ideas from other countries around the world through the eyes and the voices of their writers.
Ye come here, gather round the stage. The time has come for us to voice our rage against the ones who've trapped us in a cage to steal from us the value of our wage from underneath the vestiture of law. The lobbyists at Washington do gnaw at liberty, the bureaucrats guffaw. And until they are purged, we won't withdraw. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. Our nation was built upon the right of every person to improve their plight. The laws of this republic they rewrite. And now a few own everything in sight. They own it free of liability. They own that they are not like you and me. Their influence dictates legality. And until they are stopped, we are not free. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. enforce your monopolies with guns while sacrificing our daughters and sons. But certain things belong to everyone. Your thievery has left the people none. So take heed of our notice to redress. We have little to lose, we must confess. Your empty words do leave us unimpressed. A growing number join us in protest. We occupy the streets, we occupy the courts, we occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. You can't divide us into sides, and from our gaze you cannot hide. Denial serves to amplify, and our allegiance you can't buy. Our government is not for sale. The banks do not deserve a bail. We will not reward those who fail. We will not move till we prevail. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. We are the many, you are the few.